From London, England, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. The University of Oklahoma's Vice President of Student Affairs and Dean of Students, Clark Stroud, is here with me in London, England this week. He joins me to discuss the coal mine disaster in Turkey and how it relates to coal mining in the UK.
England's really having to struggle through kind of making decisions about how they're going to go forward and what their commitment's going to be to coal. And ultimately, in a free market, it's winning out in terms of closing down two of the last three mines here.
And later, we'll hear Rebecca Cruz's conversation with University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward. He started his career studying corporations and nonprofits to learn how to create more efficient mental health networks.
And then after 9/11, I was asked to apply that kind of knowledge to what it would be like if I were Osama bin Laden.
But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. I'm here in London with Clark Stroud. He's joining me today. Thanks for being with me, Clark.
Great to be here.
So even though we're in London, we're paying attention to the news, of course. The big news in Europe is the mine explosion in Turkey. So this, of course, has sparked some outrage, protests. The miners are threatening to strike over safety concerns. Something like this, of course, always raises questions about safety issues. And even Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan made this connection and, in fact, connected what happened in Turkey to mines here in England when he said that there's no such thing as accident-free work and that this is mining is clearly a dangerous job to do. And he listed off accidents that have happened in the past in England, in English coal mines. But at the same time, English coal mines were in the news here this week, Clark, talking about mine closures even before this even happened.
Yes. Two of the three deep coal mines that remain in England are slated to close, which is creating a lot of conversation over here, really from an economic standpoint, not so much safety, but the loss of jobs as well as, income tax revenue. But I think what was interesting was one of the indicators for the closure of these mines was cheaper American coal coming over. As America moves towards kind of shale-based oil and natural gas, what's happened is American coal is cheaper, and so it's not profitable anymore for these mines to operate.
Yeah, the UK announcement this week about the closing of these two mines was something that's also been not well received in this country. As you mentioned, the losing of jobs, losing of tax revenue and the economic consequences of that. But then there's that trade-off, right, between these companies being able to maintain them, the cost of maintaining them, particularly in terms of the safety issue, but at the same time losing those jobs and revenue. But coal is being traded on the global market, and you see that the British are suffering the consequences of that. But you see mines in other parts of the world, like in Turkey or perhaps in China, where we've had some recent disasters and accidents as well. There's a lot of pressure on this industry.
A lot of pressure. I liken it to American steel and what happened. You know, the great steel giants of the 19th and early 20th century. We watched international steel and cheaper steel come over and really change the face of what we now call the Rust Belt in the U.S. And so England's really having to struggle through kind of making decisions about how they're going to go forward and what their commitment's going to be to coal. And ultimately, in a free market, it's winning out in terms of, closing down two of the last three mines here.
Well, this leads us, Clark, to perhaps think about some of our impressions of London this week, and particularly these economic impressions as we're talking about economic issues in this country. I mean, the one thing that's really struck me as we've been here, and I've been to London many times, and so it just keeps happening every time I come here, how diverse this city is and how we see people from around the world speaking lots of different languages, obviously from lots of cultural backgrounds. Very, very fascinating to see.
Indeed. I'm amazed at the diversity in this city. 40% of the inhabitants of this city are not Londoners, and it's an incredibly international city. It's very cosmopolitan. But I think what's interesting about it is the diversity. While there's ethnic diversity and cultural diversity, there's very little socioeconomic diversity. I mean, these are wealthier people that are living here because this city is so expensive.
That's clearly the case. I mean, even though this is a great tourist destination and people of all kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds could come and visit, they definitely can't live here. I mean, we met some alums this week who were talking about how expensive it is to live here, how much they pay for a flat, and how nobody on their street is English. So this is something that I think we'll continue to watch as London and as England changes in the years to come.
Yeah, this is Europe's most populous city, and it's attracting Europeans from all over the continent. The alumna that you were referencing, she pays $8,000 a month for 1,000 square feet in a flat, and it's just mind-boggling. And so ultimately, the people that are here are people that have means.
Well, that's for sure. It's definitely an interesting city, but an expensive one, and something that that they'll have to continue to deal with as they grow and develop. Well, thank you, Clark, for being with me today as we continue on our 4-city tour of Europe with OU students. We will be reporting again soon.
Thanks for having me.
If you have any questions or comments, let us know through the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or at Suzette Grelot. Coming up, Rebecca Cruz talks with University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward about his work with so-called dark networks. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward has spent more than 3 decades studying management strategies and network collaboration. It may not sound very interesting, but after the attacks of September 11, 2001, his career took a radical turn when he started using that research to understand how groups like Al-Qaeda run their organizations. He spoke with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz about these so-called dark networks.
Brent Millward, welcome to Worldviews. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. Well, we wanted to talk with you a little bit about these so-called dark networks. Now, when I generally think of networks, I talk with my students and often tell them they need to go network to find jobs and they need to meet people and do that sort of thing. But that's not what you're talking about here. You're talking about more of a nefarious type of network.
That's correct. We're talking about networks that are illegal according to the laws of the state. And because they're illegal, they have to remain covert or they'll be killed or captured. So it's really the same principle of going out and networking and creating relationships with people who have affinity with what you're doing. But in this case, it's illegal. Now, some of that is, you know, we may view it as really terrible, like Al-Qaeda. On the other hand, there are plenty of examples of dark networks who from the standpoint of history, look pretty good. The von Stauffenberg network to kill Hitler, for example, was illegal and a dark network according to the laws of Nazi Germany. The African National Congress under Nelson Mandela, who just passed away, we've looked at that as a dark network. What we try to do is simply look at the organizational principles of what it's like to manage when people are out to kill you or capture you, and because of that, you have to be covert and make all kinds of choices that you wouldn't have to make if you were a legal corporation.
Okay, so you can take some of the knowledge that you've accumulated about legal corporations and use that to understand how these dark networks are working.
Well, legal corporations, nonprofits, government agencies, partnerships, collaborative partnerships. I studied mental health networks and how to create more effective and efficient healthcare networks for most of my career. And then after 9/11, I was asked to apply that kind of knowledge to what it would be like if I were Osama bin Laden. And what are the kinds of choices I would have to make? How would I have to make sort of suboptimal decisions because I needed to be clandestine? So the real terrorist dilemma is to act or to exist. That's the fundamental choice. It's very, very simple. The more you act, the more people know where you are. They can find you better, but you can also hit your enemy. On the other hand, if you want to exist, what you do is you go back to the caves in Afghanistan. You try to lay low, not use cell phones. But the people in whose name you operate think, what are we supporting these people for? They're not doing anything. So that's the terrible trade-off that every leader of a dark network faces.
You've mentioned Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. We could probably also think of organized crime and some of these other operatives that are trafficking in illegal substances and people as well. What have we learned about how they operate? How is the network actually formed and how does it grow?
Well, that's a great question, and it's one that people are just really starting to look at. For about the last 15 years, we've looked at networks relatively statically, sort of how did it get to where it is now? But the real important thing to do is to figure out how did it begin? Where did it get to a point where it was successful or maybe where it failed, because plenty of these networks fail? So we're just getting into that right now, and that we have the tools now. Social network analysis has moved to the point where we have very, very sophisticated modeling tools that I think in the next 4 or 5 years are going to let us make some real progress on this question and try to predict which ones are going to succeed and which ones are going to fail. We already know sort of points of intervention, sort of where they're most vulnerable. And in fact, if you take a look at what the United States has done in the tribal areas of Afghanistan and Yemen and other places, or what with the cooperation in Mexico with the capture of El Chapo Guzman, I mean, this is an example of sort of the technology I'm talking about being used to interdict networks and take out strategic nodes.
The technology you mentioned, this, of course, it's changing in the last 20 years. Globalization has increased. The speed of globalization, at least, has increased. And these networks are able to operate across borders much more efficiently. Is this a situation where we or states, law enforcement, are always going to be a step behind? Or do you think we might be able to catch up? It seems that there's an attack that occurs and we're somewhat reactionary, or there's illegal trafficking and we stop one pipeline but another opens up. Are we going to be able to get ahead of this with some of this theory that you're talking about?
I certainly hope so, but it's very difficult. T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, once said that fighting an insurgency is like eating soup with a knife. It's very hard. And particularly if the network is viewed as legitimate by the people in whose name it operates. The real key, I think, is figuring out ways to counter the legitimacy of these networks. And one of the ways you do that is to have a government that treats its people better, doesn't jail them without any particular cause, that can provide useful services, that can provide, first of all, above all else, peace and order. I mean, if you can't provide law and order, there's not much reason for supporting a government. And so that is the kind of thing that we've learned is really important in decreasing the legitimacy of many of these dark networks.
And how do we go about researching these networks? Obviously, you mentioned they're clandestine. How do we get information about them?
Very carefully.
Very carefully.
Most of it is second best. I mean, first of all, you need to understand all data is biased in some way. All data is incomplete, has strengths and weaknesses, no matter whether it's economic data on the state of unemployment in the United States or whether it's the state of Al-Qaeda's health. So we use multiple sources. The work that I do, and there are plenty of people who do this, but I don't use any classified sources. I've come to believe that the kind of strategic analysis that I do doesn't really require information about tactics. You know, where is somebody right now? What cave is this person in? So I'm really looking at a bigger picture of what it's like to manage these networks. So I read, and my students, we've got a large research group at the University of Arizona focused on this. We have some of the top people in the world who helped invent many of these social network methods to study this. We have people in computer engineering that have built these remarkable software packages for the military that we're able to use. And so we can digest vast amounts of data to look for connections between individuals, organizations, and events in a zone of conflict.
University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward speaking with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz. We'll hear more of the conversation right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Let's get back to our conversation with University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward. Before the break, he described how there's a massive amount of unclassified social network analysis and data available that can help understand how organizations like Al-Qaeda operate. He's speaking with Worldviews contributor Rebecca Cruz.
One of the things we often hear perhaps as a criticism is the disconnect between what academia is doing and what policymakers are doing. And this sounds like you're collecting very, very valuable information. I'm just curious of how that's being interpreted by our policymakers, by the people in power, how that collaboration is going.
I've really had a wonderful relationship with the agencies that fund me. And the agencies that fund me are anywhere from just traditional places like National Science Foundation to the Air Force Labs. And we've put together on a big multi-campus research initiative a remarkable and strange group of people, theoretical physicists, mathematicians, historians, anthropologists, people like me, organization theorists, sociologists, political scientists. And I think that's really the key to making a great deal of headway here, bringing disciplines together and around a common problem. I mean, we have a very well-defined problem. How do adversarial networks operate under conditions of great stress? That's what all these different disciplines are trying to help us understand. So I think that we've accomplished a lot.
How has this network theory been able to increase collaboration internally? We have a lot of different agencies that are involved in fighting terrorism, fighting trafficking. And prior to 9/11 in particular, we heard a lot about the agency disconnect. So can we use some of the information that you've learned to bring these groups together to better fight networks, these dark networks?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because one of the things I have done is done executive training for the intelligence community. The intelligence community has done a number of things. They've required that people at Central Intelligence Agency take a joint duty posting at the FBI, for example. And their promotion depends on their spending time in another agency and starting to understand that agency's culture, whether it's National Security Agency, CIA, DIA, or the FBI, or any of the other members of the community. And I think that's really important. But remember, these are agencies that were set up to keep secrets and try to keep information not out there in the public domain, although Edward Snowden has certainly put a crimp in that plan. And we know a lot more about what these agencies do now than we did a year ago.
We were talking before the interview about some of these organizations and about why some dark networks persist and others don't persist. And I know one that you've looked into is the LTTE, the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Lam in Sri Lanka, an organization that existed for, gosh, about 30 years.
Right.
And is now, there may be some remnants of it, but for the most part, the civil war there has ended and they are not a power player. So what did they do wrong, or what were they doing successfully that let them persist for so long? And then what did they do wrong that led to their demise?
Sort of a cascading series of mistakes that very often happen. You had splits in the leadership structure, and you had internal fights. This certainly is true with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So internal fighting is one thing. The other thing they did was they lost a critical Battle of Elephant Pass, and so they started to retreat back into an area where there really was no escape except the sea. And they started fighting more like conventional armies. And when they did that, they become much easier for, you know, the Sri Lankan army to bomb and to find them and kill and capture them wherever they are. And eventually they pushed them into the sea. There was no exit. I mean, a vast number of civilians, Tamil civilians, were killed. But it was just really a crushing defeat.
Is this an organization that you think could rise up again if they restructured, or is this an organization we've seen the last of?
Well, the thing we have learned is that dark networks are driven by problems. In this case, the problem of the Tamils in Sri Lanka did not go away, and it will persist. It may take 15, 20, 30 years. Who knows? I mean, the African National Congress in South Africa was almost destroyed when Nelson Mandela and the entire leadership of the ANC was arrested in 1962, and took them 13 years to get back to where they had been when they were all arrested at this Lily's Leaf farm in South Africa. So if problems don't go away, these things will come back. And that's the message, I think, our primary message for governments. And that is, you can't kill or capture your way to success. That I won't say that removing people like Osama bin Laden is a bad idea. I think it's a very good idea. But the problems that they represent, unless something is done about them, they're going to come back and they'll continue to fester, and people will continue to organize. And another generation of policymakers will be dealing with this.
Well, and as with the case with Osama bin Laden, the structure of the organization had changed somewhat in the past 10 years. So I think many have argued that capturing him didn't eradicate the organization. The leadership just filled in.
Well, then there's the question of what is al-Qaeda?
Very
Al-Qaeda
true.
On 9/11 does not exist anymore. But you have franchises that claim to act in its name all over the Islamic world. For a while, it was just different franchises, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or al-Nusra in Syria. And now you're starting to see the infighting themselves among these franchise groups.
So it seems that it's very important that we understand the individual dark networks in order to target them and to understand them and to combat them.
That's exactly right.
Okay. And thinking about Guzman, who you mentioned earlier, do you think that his capture is going to alter the situation with the drug war in Mexico? I know you're not an expert necessarily in that part of the world, but he's been a very large figure here in the last decade or so. Is taking out his leadership going to have an effect?
Will it have any effect on the war on drugs? No. There are plenty of lieutenants who will pick up the banner, and the demand in the United States has not changed. And unless that demand changes, the same number of drugs will come into the United States, and I would predict that you'll find the same kind of fighting among the would-be successors to El Chapo, so that you have sort of unorganized corruption, which is really worse than organized corruption, because a lot of innocent people get killed when it's unorganized, and that's when it really gets bloody. Unless something is done to deal with the lieutenants. Now, one of the things that I read in the Wall Street Journal this morning was that the intelligence that we had on Guzman was so profound that we're able to get down two or three layers of his lieutenants. And if that's the case, then you possibly could wipe out all the people who have critical organizational or drug smuggling or drug making skills and really deal the organization a blow. But if the Sinaloa cartel goes away, the Mexicali cartel, comes up, or another cartel.
So it sounds like there's two takeaways here. One, that we need to understand the organization, the network, and the other, that we need to understand the context in which they derive in order to combat them effectively.
Exactly. The takeaway for me is that problems drive dark networks, and you need to combat dark networks, but you also need to combat the problems that created them as well.
Well, this is just a fascinating discussion of how we can take some theory from business and organizations and take that and look at a completely different area. So we appreciate your time today, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Rebecca Cruz's conversation with University of Arizona political scientist Brent Millward. You can learn more about his research involving dark networks on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a joint project of KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Nick Aguilera prepared the research for this interview, and the program is produced by Brian Hardzinski. For Clark Stroud and Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzanne Rolott.